Thank you, Melissa, for that very gracious introduction. Melissa has been after me for years. I have been extremely elusive. Katona's not that far from Amherst, but it's hard to get from there to here. But I am thrilled that I finally made it. And I'm also very thrilled that as many of you have showed up this evening. I feel morally required to observe that there were, in Ellis' version, founding brothers, six founders who together rested atop the American version of Mount Olympus. In order to qualify for this, again, by my lights, you had to be a prominent leader in both foundings. There are two foundings. One, when we declare our independence in 1776, that means the political decision and the war itself to win it. And then when we announce our nationhood in 1787, that means involvement in the process of the convention, the ratification, and the institutionalization of a Republican government in the 1790s. By that criteria, there are six Oscar winners. And they are the people you would imagine. They are George Washington, who is the foundingest father of them all. And they all agreed about that. Jay agreed about that. Benjamin Franklin, probably better known worldwide than Washington. Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton. Now, on the front cover of Founding Brothers is a picture of Aaron Burr. I never said he was a real member, and he just got in because he was present for the duel. But up until now, then what we've been talking about is the Magnificent Six. And you might be able to tell where I'm going. It is now the Magnificent Seven. I mean, there's no way to measure this. We don't have home run statistics, all that kind of thing. But do what Jay always do. If you know you're going to win, be patient. He was patient about slavery. He was patient about the new nation. His papers, as they come out, will be sufficiently lustrous, and especially the correspondence with Sarah. There will be, I'm not sure that he'll find a Miranda to do a play about him. Where are the Hamilton people back there? There is a good biography by Walter Starr. It's very good. It's not great. He needs a great biographer. I'll see if I can help. I'm not sure. We'll see. I want to talk to you tonight about the founding of the American Republic and the book I wrote called Quartet. I say talk. I believe the written word is meant to be read and the spoken word is meant to be heard, and that they are different genres. The advantages of the spoken word are great, especially in terms of succinctness and cogency. But I think that the advantage of speaking to you this way allows me to interact with you. And that, to me, allows for improvisation and the emergence of an idea that I might not even know I had. And I think that's the best way to do it. I've given talks on the book, obviously, in lots of different places. But for this one, I want it to be different. And therefore, it's a new way of doing it. Because I want to filter everything through Jay. And it doesn't require too much twisting and engineering, intellectual engineering, to do that. And in order to start the ball in that direction, I want you to envision a scene. It's August 7th, 1782. It's a big room. It looks like a ballroom in Paris. And two men are hunched over a table. The table is walnut in the middle of this big room. One of them is John Jay, and the other is a Spanish minister named Count Aranda. Not Orlando, because everybody thinks it's the same guy whom Florida is named. It's not. Jay is one of the American representatives, diplomatic representatives, to conduct negotiations to end the war with Great Britain. 8 months earlier, Yorktown happened. That propelled the British to recognize that continuing the war was politically impossible. The leverage in these diplomatic negotiations belonged to the Americans. There is a famous painting by Benjamin West called The Treaty of Paris, showing all the American representatives and their secretary, and there's a gap in it to the right side of the painting. It's a famous painting, famous for its gap, because the British delegates refused to show up. They did not want to be memorialized for the greatest defeat in the history of the British Empire. They're hunched over the map. Aranda points to a place in Lake Erie and draws a line down through what is now Toledo to what is now Tallahassee, and says, everything to the east of that line is yours, and everything to the west is ours, Spain's. Jay doesn't have to draw a line. He just points to the Mississippi. Everything east of that is ours, everything west is yours, and this matter is non-negotiable. Wow. This is a very bold act on his part, because he's under instructions from the Continental Congress to do nothing without consulting the French. The French have saved our bacon with troops and money. Franklin himself, one of the other diplomats, is wedded to the French. Adams isn't, but Adams is up in Amsterdam dealing with the Dutch bankers. The other person, Jefferson, hasn't made it across, in fact has decided not to come because of the threat of being captured on the high seas, and he's replaced by Henry Lawrence, and Lawrence does get captured on the high seas and thrown into the dungeon, but he's traded or exchanged for Cornwallis, and he's going to make it in time for the portrait. But nothing else. Anyway, this moment over the map is extraordinary because, as you know, they didn't have cell phones then. And therefore, a minister couldn't call back to the capital, in this case it would have been in New York, and say, I need to break my instructions. I need to negotiate an independent treaty with Great Britain and essentially sell out the French. He can't do that. But he goes back to Franklin's quarters. Franklin's got the gout, and he says, that's what we're going to do. This is one of the most important decisions in the whole revolutionary era. It changes the entire political chemistry of the United States. It means, while the great principle won is independence, the great prize is an empire, the transmontane West. And they call it the domain. Geologists whom I know more about this than historians. This area that we get in 25,000 BC was covered by an ice sheet 2 miles thick. Underneath the ice sheet is the biggest river on Earth. It doesn't have a name because no human being ever saw it. When the ice starts to really melt in 25,000 BC, this huge river splits and creates the Ohio Valley and the Mississippi Valley. This is the best watered plot of land of this size on Earth. This means this is the most, then these rivers have overflown, effluvial plains have formed over 10,000 years. This is the most fertile place on the planet. It also happens, I know the governor doesn't like this, but it's got shale oil up there in New York too. They didn't care about that. Anyway, it also changes the political chemistry of the United States. And why requires another great moment? Well, ask it in the form of a question. I'll put it to you this way. The first clause in the first sentence of the most famous speech in American history is historically incorrect. That asks you to figure out what the most famous speech in American history is. Now, there are several, I would say there are three viable candidates. Fourscore is the winner. The other one is, figure it out. I Have a Dream. And how about ask not what you can do for your country, that kind of, the country can do it. All right. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation. No, they didn't. And there's a very big reason why Lincoln has to make this historically incorrect argument, because the truth is the Confederation has a legitimate constitutional point when it secedes from the Union in 1861. Namely, that in 1776, now if he had said 1787, not 1786, 1776, he'd have a stronger case. But in 1776, the 13 colonies come together to declare their independence as sovereign states. The specific resolution, July 2nd, Richard Henry Lee wrote it from Virginia, that these 13 colonies are and have every reason to be independent states. We don't rebel as a nation. We rebel as a confederation of 13 sovereign states. And the government created, it's not really a government, it's like a League of Nations, is called the Articles of Confederation, and sovereignty resides in the particular states. How do you know that really is true? Figure out, look at how they treat the Continental Army during the war. Washington is requesting troops and supplies throughout the war. He actually says, if you gave me what we could, if what I asked for, I'm asking for 88,000 troops. The population of the United States as currently constituted can field an army of 200,000 men. All I want is 88,000. If you give me 88,000, I'll win the war in a year. What do they give him? 10 to 12,000. No state ever fills its levy. No state ever pays what these people are requesting, salary-wise. That's the reason they're all starving, too, by the way. And the troops in the South literally are wearing loincloths. And that's why at the end of the war, when they've promised them a pension, they say, I'm sorry, we don't have any money, no pension. Go home as beggars. That's what happens to the Continental Army. So that the United States begins as a confederation that has no desire to be a nation. Think about this. What's the argument that the colonists have been hurling at Great Britain for 10 years? That you have no right, Parliament, to tax us because you do not represent our interest, because you're too far away. Also, we don't have any representatives. They make the same argument about any kind of national government. Doesn't, you know, a representative is somebody that knows me personally, is proximate. Therefore, nationhood is incompatible with the principles of 76. The largest area would be a state. Later in the Virginia Ratifying Convention, Patrick Henry puts it very nicely. He said, let me see if I understand this. Suppose we agree to this Constitution, and all the other states vote for a tax measure, and Virginia and its Senate representatives and its congressional representatives votes against it. We are therefore being taxed without our consent. See the way they think? A normal person, average person, there's no such thing, I guess, a normal person, born in the Revolutionary era, grown up, he or she is born, lives out his life, and dies within a 28-mile radius. They don't think beyond their local communities. They don't have means of communicating with people beyond their neighbors. For them to think nationally is psychologically as well as politically impossible. And yet, this guy Jay has just given them an empire. And a confederation cannot govern an empire. Think about it. And that's what begins to become clear in the 1780s when Jay goes to be head of what he called superintendent of foreign policy, foreign affairs under the Confederation Congress. Jay recognizes from the beginning when he takes office, and by the way, everybody wants Jay to do this so badly that the government at that time has been moving about from Philadelphia to Princeton to Annapolis to Trenton. And it's in Trenton. And Jay says, you want me to do this job? I'm just coming back from Madrid where he had nothing to do but cool his heels. And they say, we desperately want you. He says, the only way I'll do it is if you move the capital to New York because I want to be with my wife. They say, okay. That's how the capital moves to New York. Jay is aware of the fact that each state believes that it's responsible for its own foreign policy. Adams is writing him from London. Abigail joins in with this, saying, people laugh at us over here. We represent the United States. That doesn't exist. Massachusetts has its own tariff policy with London. New York, big on having tariffs. It charges Rhode Island, Connecticut, big tariffs. It's the reason why New York's going to oppose ratification. It's doing really well. Also, it's foreclosing on loyalist estates in New York City illegally, because that's against the Treaty of 1783. They say, screw that. We just take the land, you know? So it's the reason New York's going to be very late to the game in terms of ratification. Jay is the first person to say to Washington in 1786, sir, it is clear to all thinking men, me like you and me, that this government will not last, indeed is not a government, and we're headed towards anarchy. It really won't be anarchy. It'll be a series of regional confederations, New England, but anyway. And that you are likely to be called back. From retirement. Because only you can move towards that new goal of American nationhood with historical credibility. He's right because that direction is unpopular. There are no mobs forming for a constitutional convention. Exactly the opposite. Jay also says what we need is to realize that the government we have here under the Confederation isn't a government, and that the state, the model for the state governments, the state constitutions, of which I wrote one in New York, is the proper model. It needs to have three branches: governor, bicameral legislature, independent judiciary. The article just has one thing, a Congress, that's it. The head of the Congress is called president because he doesn't do anything, he just presides. If you think about that title, by the way. Anyway, he's the first one to recognize the articles don't need to just be reformed, they need to be replaced. And the only way that can happen politically is if Washington plays a central role. Being a leader, in the end, means knowing where history is headed before everybody else does. And that's why Jay's great, because he knows that here. This is exactly the way it's going to play. Washington says, forget me, I'm not leaving. He's got two reasons that he doesn't want to participate. One, he has declared himself the American Cincinnatus, or has been so declared. Cincinnatus is the great Roman general who retires and turns his sword into plowshares. The one thing that Cincinnatus cannot do is come back. I can't come back. Second, he doesn't say this to Jay, he says it to Lafayette more frequently. He believes he's going to die. He's in his 50s. No male in the Washington line has lived past 59 in four generations. His letters are pretty eloquent on this. There's a phrase he uses, gliding down the stream of life. And with Lafayette, it's very elegiac. He says that I will soon be going to the dark ancestral mansion, meaning into the ground. And I do not repine, I have had my day. He thinks it's over for him. He thinks his great achievement has been winning the war, and that's it. That's good enough. By the way, he hates when one of the arguments that his secretary, he got a new secretary, comes in. What's his name? Who is it? Now that's he comes later. Yes, Humphrey, David Humphreys, thank you. He says, look, one of the things is if you agree to leading any effort for a constitutional convention, first of all, it's likely to fail, and that's going to hurt. Secondly, even if it succeeds, guess what's going to happen? You're going to be nominated the first president. The last thing you want. You're never getting back to Mount Vernon. None of that vine and fig tree stuff for you. And he really, anyway, and Washington doesn't want to be president. No president in American history did not want to be president more than George Washington. I can just imagine Washington's speech that he would be giving Mr. Trump when he's nominated for the presidency by the Republican Party. I'm not worthy of this honor. I have not sought it, and do not believe that you should vote for me. Wouldn't that be great? Yeah, and I shall not campaign, since I regard that as an act of prostitution. Anyway, I'm going on. Jay does persuade him, and he's joined, and Madison comes into the play here as one of the quartet. And there's people that form around Washington. It's Jay, Madison, Hamilton, and Henry Knox, who is Washington's former artillery officer. Notice J. Hamilton Madison. These are the guys who are going to write the Federalist Papers. They form initially as a team to coach Washington, first to persuade him to come, and secondly, to coach him, since he knows a lot about what the answers are in terms of, I want us to become a sovereign nation where sovereignty resides at the federal rather than the state level. I know that. Well, it's a lot more complicated than that. We're going to give you a seminar on that. And they do. All right. Because of time, you'll have to read the book. I have all kinds of undoubtedly brilliant things to say about the convention itself. They don't get what they want. They want a clear resolution of the sovereignty question. They do get, we're not reforming the Articles, we're replacing them. Technically, that's illegal. When they were given the charge to have a convention, the charge said to reform the Articles, not to throw them out the window completely. It also said that if you do propose, that any proposed reformation of the Articles must have a unanimous vote from all the states. They say, well, since that's impossible, because we all know about Rhode Island, we're going to limit that to 9 states. This is really a coup d'etat we're talking about here. This is a benevolent coup d'etat. They don't get what they want. We can talk in the Q&A about slavery. Bottom line, once you commit yourself to a union in which all 13 colonies cum states are members, you've got to deal with slavery. And deal with it means if you say slavery is unacceptable or have an article in the document that makes it clear that slavery is eventually going to be found politically impossible, it would never pass. What you get is a document that makes nobody happy. The South wants a statement guaranteeing slavery. They don't get it. The North wants a statement saying that at some point we're going to take action and put this on the road to ultimate extinction, and they don't get that. Jay is not going to make the politically correct happy. That's his position, too. One of the reasons the American Revolution succeeds as a revolution, and say the French Revolution doesn't, the Russian Revolution doesn't, the Chinese Revolution doesn't, at least according to its goals, is the American Revolution is run by conservatives. Jay's one of them. Evolutions are much, much better than revolutions. Make this a revolution that is an evolution. And as we were, as I found out from taking a brief tour of the rooms in this place, the subsequent generations of the Jay family carry this mission forward another chapter at a time. Ratification, Jay's back in the story, and we need to pay a little bit of attention to that. On the face of it, ratification is one of the most democratic moments in American history. 1,648 delegates meet in 12 states, Rhode Island holding out. Poor Rhode Island. Have you ever noticed that, until very recently, it's really hard to get from eastern Massachusetts to Rhode Island? I had a son that went to Brown. You know, it takes forever to get on back roads and get down there. Now it's been changed. But they don't. That's where you send witches and Quakers and crazy people. Theological nutcases. Anne Hutchinson, Roger Williams. Anyway. What was I trying to talk about? Ratification. 1600, but even though it looks democratic, early in the process, Madison is the one who does this. He says there are some states that want to have a ratifying process in which they can say, yes, but with these amendments. He says you can't do that. It's up or down. Aye or nay. If you say yes, we go to the Constitution. If you say nay, we go back to the Articles. There's no middle position. That's where everybody really wants to be, is in the middle position. But he says you can't do that. And they've also said that only 9 states are necessary to ratify. Where the heck did they get that? They just made it up. There is a sequence in the ratification process that is interactive and it builds. If you're early in the process, if you're late in the process, New York is late, Virginia's late. They're two of the biggest states. Virginia's much bigger than New York at this stage. The strategy is get to 9. Get to 9 before you get to New York and Virginia, and then the ball game's over. It doesn't make any difference then. Once you get to 9, they'll all be forced to join. New York is, apart from Rhode Island, the most intransigent state. New York is 3-1 within the ratifying convention opposed to ratification. Debate makes absolutely no difference inside the New York Ratification Convention, which is being held in Poughkeepsie, because nobody's going to change their mind. Jay understands this. So does Hamilton. And Jay and Hamilton do one thing, you won't have seen this, that's really, they say, our job is to delay a vote. Jay does deliver one oration that's printed in, you know, I think it's an Albany paper, that's one of the most interesting. I mean, if it wasn't included in the Federalist Papers, if it was put in the Federalist Papers, it would be one of the best ones. It's called An Address to the Citizens of New York. And it's, what it does is make the case that this is a continuation of the American Revolution. That's really the most politically interesting case. Nobody else has made that case. Jay makes it. But that he knows, just as he knows if he's going to win, he can be patient. In this case, he knows if he's not patient, he's going to lose. So one of the things they do is, their most important thing is to set up a team of riders between Richmond and Poughkeepsie. It's like the Pony Express. As soon as Virginia ratifies, let us know, because then we can shut up. It turns out New Hampshire unexpectedly ratifies before Virginia. And it becomes the 9th state. The Federalist Papers have a claim on our attention as, and America is perhaps the most profound deliberation on Republican government. I don't disagree with the word profound, but you got to see, these were done at white heat as all-nighters. There wasn't any deliberation at all. Madison was changing it as the typist was putting in the type. Hamilton was writing on the top of a barrel on a sloop between Albany and Poughkeepsie. And Jay would have ended up writing more than 5, but he got hit in the head by a rock defending this hospital against an attack by a mob. He also probably had some form of rheumatism as well. The thing that's interesting about the Federalist Papers, from a historian's point of view, is it's difficult for us to appreciate. And you have to look at all the other debates going on at the time to understand. The Federalists are the only ones that view this issue from a national perspective. Everybody else in all the states look at it from their state's perspective, or more frequently, from their county's perspective or their town's perspective. They can't see the whole. The Federalists see the whole, and Jay is really good at that. I want to finish up with something that doesn't involve Jay, but he, because of his career as first Chief Justice, I think he would want me to do this. We have this thing called the Bill of Rights. Here, the major player is Madison. If you ask me whether Madison's the major player in the Constitutional Convention, I would say, I would say Gouverneur Morris, New Yorker, peg-leg New Yorker, ladies' man, who's more outspoken on slavery and actually speaks more often and doesn't lose as many debates. Why did they not include a Bill of Rights in the original document? Madison makes up all kinds of fake stories to explain this. Well, we decided that if we started listing the rights, we might miss some, and therefore we decided it'd be better not to try to do that. Or the states all have constitutions with bills of rights, and therefore we don't need the blah, blah, blah. The real reason is because they were all tired and they wanted to go home. And it was September, and they'd been spending ever since mid-May, and half of them were already gone. They weren't going to have a quota. But in the end, in the debates and the ratification process, it becomes really clear that that was a big blunder, that the protests in the states that are questioning ratification seriously, the anti-federalist position is rooted, it would have been answered in most cases if they had had a Bill of Rights in the document, which specifies certain things the federal government cannot do, or a zone where it can't function. Madison decides afterwards, well, we don't need a Bill of Rights. It doesn't. Jefferson tries to say we need a Bill of Rights. He's writing from Paris, by the way. He's over there, you know, he thinks, you know, it's really great. Jefferson's sitting over there, he's sort of saying, we need a revolution, or a new constitution every generation. You know, it's like, here's Madison, just spent his 2 years of his life trying to sweat this thing in. This is only going to last 20 or 25 years. Jefferson doesn't care about constitutions. He cares about Bill of Rights. He doesn't care about what government can do. He cares a lot about what it can't do. Anyway, Madison, in the spring of 1789, as elected to the new government as representative of Virginia, comes to the conclusion that he's got to put together a Bill of Rights. Why? Six states, including New York, have, upon ratification, also submitted recommended amendments. Madison has successfully argued you cannot make conditional amendments, you can make recommended amendments. Got that? If you make conditional amendments, then your vote is a negative for the Constitution. Oh, we won't do that. Six states make, and the total number of amendments is like 200. And if you go through them and knock out duplications, there's 128. The 128 amendments. And Madison says, in order to appease the states that have ratified but with great reluctance, I'm going to do a Bill of Rights comprised mostly of what they said they would recommend. Okay? So he sits down and takes these 128 recommended amendments. He is also worried about something called a second convention movement, which has been started by Governor Clinton in New York, that says, we're not happy with the way this has happened. I mean, in New York, think of it this way. New York knew that they had the votes, right? We can knock this thing out. It's no, and all of a sudden, they lose. It's like, what? And therefore, we're going to lead a movement for a second convention. That's a recipe to mean nothing's going to happen, and meaning that they're going to go back to the articles. New York likes the way things are. They're making a lot of money with their tariffs in New York Harbor. They're closing all these loyalist states. Things are great. Clinton's got his own bailiwick. They have more to lose than gain by joining the Union. Jay says at this point, and this is again typical Jay, Madison's really worried. You know, oh my God, second convention. You know, by the way, Hamilton is not that worried because he says, look, if they threaten that, I'll just take New York City and we'll secede. We'll secede and go to Connecticut. Or now, it might have been New Jersey, I'm not sure. And Jay says, they're bluffing. They're just upset because they lost. This whole second convention thing is just an hallucination. Let them rant and rave. They're not going to go anywhere. And that means you don't have to write a Bill of Rights. As Jay is concerned, the Bill of Rights is unnecessary. When Madison first writes it, he takes 128 and he reduces it to about 15. By the way, he thinks he's got to find where they should be inserted in the document. He doesn't think of them as an end. He said then it would be like a tail of a dog. And he can't find where to put them, and it doesn't fit. And then somebody says, I think the representative from Connecticut and the Senate says, you can't do that because you're changing the document that everybody signed. You can't do that. He goes, oh. So I guess we have to put it at the end as a kind of codicil. So what becomes the codicil at the end of the Constitution and a kind of American Magna Carta wasn't supposed to be that, and Madison never thought you needed it in the first place. To bring it to your attention here, the Second Amendment represented Madison's attempt to understand what four states had said in their recommendation against a standing army. Four of the states had said, we want national defense to be in the hands of state militia, not a standing army. That's what the Second Amendment is about. The decision written by Scalia or his Harvard acolytes in D.C. versus Heller in 2008, a 32-page long decision that finds the right to bear arms in the original intent of the Second Amendment is absolute crap. If you want to make a case for the right to bear arms, go find it and make it. You cannot make it on original intent. You cannot make it on the intent of Madison in writing the Second Amendment. It is absolutely impossible to do so. And indeed, that's where I want to end, and so I can have some time for some questions from you. I want to conclude with the doctrine of original intent itself, because this is a legal doctrine that I believe that Jay himself would have found troubling. And I'm going to allow Jefferson to have the last word. Original intent means that a jurist, a federal judge, or Supreme Court judge should interpret the Constitution in terms of the intention of the original writers and framers. Here's Jefferson. Some men look at constitutions with sanctimonious reverence and deem them like the Ark of the Covenant, too sacred to be touched. They ascribe to the preceding age a wisdom more than human, and suppose that what they did to be beyond amendment. I know that age well. I belonged to it, labored with it. It deserved well of its country. But I also know that laws and institutions must go hand in hand with the progress of the human mind. As that becomes more developed, more enlightened, as new discoveries are made, new truths discovered, institutions must advance also and keep pace with the times. We might as well require a man to wear still the coat which fitted him as a boy, as civilized society to remain ever under the regime of their barbarous ancestors. So, my final words, Jefferson spoke for all the most prominent members of the revolutionary generation, including Mr. Jay, in urging posterity not to regard their political prescriptions as sacred script. It is richly ironic, but one of the few original intentions they all shared was opposition to any judicial doctrine of original intent. To be sure, they all wish to be remembered and would be pleased to see you here today. But they did not want to be embalmed. Thank you very much.
Picks up the questions for the recording. So have at it.
I shall do that. Sir.
How well did Jay know Jefferson and what was their relationship?
He knew him not well. His opinion of Jefferson was was filtered through the opinions of Hamilton, who was his good friend. That means he regarded Jefferson as a duplicitous scoundrel. And so did most Federalists in the 1790s. But Jay is too polite to be as outspoken as Hamilton was. There is an incredible civility to Jay. Even in the Poughkeepsie Ratifying Convention, he would get up and say things like, "Oh, sir, I cannot wait to have you repeat your arguments. I so much wish to understand them." He's really delaying, waiting for the horses to get there from Richmond. He doesn't make a point of singling Jefferson out for criticism, but what you should know is that Washington goes to his grave thinking Jefferson is the biggest liar he's ever met, and tells Martha, "Do not, when I die, never allow that man to walk on this premises." Back then, they hated him even more than some of the people did. I mean, you know, they really did. And I wrote a whole biography about this guy. Yes. Yes, sir.
What was the relationship like between Jay and Benjamin Franklin? And in particular, negotiation around the Treaty of Paris, and what was that chemistry and dynamic like?
That's an interesting question. And if you were an actor playing this role, it would leave a lot of room for the imagination, because we don't know. We know certain things. What was the relationship between Franklin and Jay, especially during the time they were in Paris together during the peace negotiations? Franklin had spent the preceding 5 years representing America in France and negotiated the Franco-American Treaty of 1778 and was smitten with all things French. Vergennes loved him, the foreign minister. And he had good reason to love them, and because, you know, they basically subsidized the American Revolution and provided military assistance without which the end might not have come when it did. Therefore, when Jay says to Franklin, we have to break our instructions, he is asking Franklin to do something he doesn't want to do. And what's unknown, and I could only imagine, and this is where you need somebody who's a novelist or a film writer, that the act of persuading Franklin is going to be a long, well, it's going to take certain persuasive skills. It's not going to happen right away. But eventually, Franklin is going to recognize it's not just that we don't get the Transmontane West. It's that the French have strategic interests different from ours. They want to improve their position in the Caribbean. They want to improve Spain's position on the continent. And all those things mean they'll trade things in North America for that. Therefore, our interests are no longer aligned. That's what I think Franklin came to see and Jay saw right away. But there's no direct evidence on what was said to them, between them. Sir. No, they're not like the Republican Party.
But I mean, it's like the millionaires of our time overthrowing our country and turning it over.
No, the question is, it's amazing that the leaders and allegedly the most wealthy members of the American colonial society end up leading this revolution, which seems not to be something that most wealthy people do. The American Revolution is not a class movement. One class is not replacing another class. It doesn't fit the definition of revolution that the French Revolution embodies, or that the Russian Revolution or the Chinese Revolution. And that's the revolution most European historians apply, you know, one class. The people who were in charge in 1775 are still in charge in 1790. They're 19% of the population is loyalist. The loyalists are not the wealthy. Wealth is evenly distributed between loyalists and the Whigs. In other words, the breakdown between Whigs and Tories isn't a matter of wealth. So that what you've got isn't a revolution, is a war for colonial independence. That's not the same thing. What makes it a revolution isn't class. At least this is my view. And Jay, this is what Jay argues in that letter to the New Yorker, residents of New York, that we free ourselves from Britain. That's step one. But step two is the creation of a nation-sized republic founded on the principle of popular sovereignty. That will become the poster child for the liberal state in the modern world. That will overthrow the European monarchies of the 19th century and then the totalitarian dictatorships of Japan, Italy, and Germany, and then later the Soviet Union in the 20th century, and become the embodiment of what we would now call democratic capitalism. They don't use either one of those words. Democracy remains an epithet. Capitalism doesn't come into the English language until 1851. But they're talking about that. And that in the republic they create, they're pre-democratic, meaning republic doesn't celebrate the people, it celebrates the public. Res publica, things of the public. What's the public? The public is the long-term interest of the people, which at any given time most people don't know. You elect people like Jay to know. It's an we would call it aristocratic position. They don't call it that, but they call it a Republican position. And that Adams always thought Jay should have been nominated to succeed Washington rather than him because he negotiated the Jay Treaty. Extremely unpopular. Perfect. Perfect. The right thing is going to be great for the United States over the next 100 years, and you did it knowing that you were going to lose all kinds of votes. Perfect. That's the guy that should be president of the United States. He's going to do the same thing himself. He would have been reelected in 1800 if he had gone to war with France. He says, I'm not going. You don't win the election. Perfect. Brightest jewel in my crown. I'd rather be right than be president. And that's what a Republican leader does. And you have to be a bit, well, like Jay to do that. Yes, sir.
Did Jay ever have much to do with Robert Morris? Because
yes.
My impression is no, but
they were together.
Robert Morris was a big part of the revolution.
Robert Morris is probably the wealthiest man in the United States in the 1770s and 80s. He's from Philadelphia. He's an immigrant. He's born in Liverpool. At the age of 21, he's made a co-partner in this Willett's company that's a shipping company in Philadelphia. And one of the first things he does, he understands markets. Certain people are this way, and I'm not one of them, but there's a bread shortage in Spain and famine. And so he buys up the entire wheat crop of eastern Pennsylvania and ships it and makes millions and millions. Anyway, he is made superintendent of finance in the Confederation Congress at the same time that Jay is named superintendent of foreign affairs. So they overlap in that role. Both of them are committed to a national vision of the government. In the case of Morris, he wants there to be a national economy with a bank. Everything Hamilton is going to do 10 years later is exactly what Morris proposes in 1782-83. Everything. And by the way, the first person that Washington asked to be Secretary of Treasury is Morris. Morris has been vilified by Beardian historians because he has a lot of money. But in Ellis's view, Morris is not that way. I told you that the Continental Army was promised a pension. Even before that, give you an example. They got, all of a sudden, the British Army traps itself on a peninsula in Yorktown. Washington says, we got to get down there and plug it up. We don't have the money to get the troops down there. Morris says, how much do you need? Washington says, $617,000. Here's a check to me. When the government doesn't pay the soldiers their pension, thank you. Can't come up with the right word. He says, I can't leave office knowing that I've participated in such a travesty. I can only make it a slightly better. Here's a check for another $600,000 check to give everybody $40. This is a good guy. By the way, this guy, I'm talking about, this guy invests in Western land after he leaves office. And almost everybody that invests big time in Western land loses everything because the population doesn't get out there fast enough to be able to let the value rise. And then there's nobody there who can enforce copy or what do you call it? Patent rights. So you say you own this, who says you own it, you know? And what's the border? Anyway, he loses everything. And he's thrown in debtor's prison in Philadelphia. And when the capital moves to Philadelphia, George Washington comes and plays chess with him in prison. Somebody needs to write this one up too, you know. They're good buddies. They're friends, Morris, and as compatriots in a cause. And during the Constitutional Convention, Washington and his entourage stays in Morris's house and lives in Morris's house in Philadelphia. We'll take one more, and then we got to go, sir.
What role do you think he would have played when he
Madison? If Jefferson had been present in Philadelphia during the convention, what side would he have been on? That's a great question. And in fact, they debate it back then in the Virginia convention, Virginia ratifying convention, because Patrick Henry, who is the opponent of ratification, says, we have it on good information that Mr. Jefferson, who's in Paris, opposes this document, opposes this Constitution. And Madison says, I'm sorry, I have it on even better favor. He's my best friend. He's told me he supports this. Jefferson's position is equivocal at the time. He basically wants He said, I don't see why you've done this. It's the fabric of the articles had a hole in it. Why don't we just mend the hole instead of replacing the whole fabric? His mature position as a Secretary of State, then Vice President, then President, is the federal government has no right to make domestic policy. It can make foreign policy, but not domestic policy. States' rights with regard to all internal stuff. Okay, later, part of the reason for this, not the only reason at the time, it will become the major reason later, is once you acknowledge this federal government's right to make domestic policy, slavery is on the table. Okay? For him, it's more complicated than that. Anyway, let's make it really speculative. Suppose you take Jay, Jefferson, Washington, and Madison and say, what would they have done in 1861? Jay and Washington, they're with the Union. Jefferson's with the Confederacy. And Madison, depends on the day of the week and the color of this hat. Thank you very much.